This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
The title of the book, Precipice, This Generation Series, Book 1. And also, we're going to be talking about Book 2, Pentecost, and the author is T.C. Joseph, and T.C. joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, T.C.
Well, hello. How are you today?
Great to have you with us. It wasn't very long ago. Well, it was a few years ago, but the whole world was focused on December 21st, 2012, and you were focused on it as well.
Absolutely. You know, I have a career in business. I was controller of a large multinational company, and I took an early retirement to take care of my mother, who had a massive stroke, and I still do that. I do daily care for her. We just had our 8-year anniversary on that. So I had a lot of time on my hands, and I was noticing all of this hysteria. And I had a background in Christian Bible prophecy. And so I started looking into what are other cultures thinking? What are other cultures considering about this time in which we live? And I found like there are Hopi prophecies. There are Islamic prophecies, there are Christian prophecies, there are, even the New Age movement has some thoughts about what is going to happen in this generation. So it puzzled me on why prophecies or thoughts that people are having that are time-specific mark this particular generation. So I wanted to take a look at those things and see what if all of them are right. What if they're all looking at a certain string of events but they're looking at it from different perspectives, and how would that play out in the lives of several families? And so that's what we do in Precipice. We look at a group of individuals in 1969, then we skip forward to 1979 and then 1989, and we see how these worldviews are influencing their lives. And in Pentecost, we pick up at 1999, 2009, and present day. And then Penance, the one that was just released this November, takes us into the near future.
Well, and as we all remember, December 21st, 2012, the end of the Mayan calendar, which generated all kinds of questions and almost hysteria with some people. Okay, they thought the whole world was coming to an end.
Right. And I think what it did was lay bare something that is going on in the hearts and minds of people worldwide, that things can't continue on as they are going right now. You know, that something's got to give. Society is strained to the max. The worldwide population is growing too fast for our ability to feed it. Something has to happen. And I think there's just this innate sense. And I think that's what the December 21st, 2012 hysteria laid bare. You know, it's actually, I saw an advertisement for a television show coming on the American Hero Channel, AHC, talking about it, how will the world end. And so they go through the most likely scenarios for an apocalyptic event in the world, and you know, they are just tapping into that same sense that things can't go on the way they have been, and even the most recent election in the United States, you know, people are for or against, and we tend to make our candidates devils or saviors when in reality they're just candidates stepping into a very powerful position, but again they are not in control of the world the way we like to think that they are. So I think that what we're seeing in all of this hysteria is an innate feeling, a feeling in people's hearts that things just aren't right.
Well, it's kind of like this Left Behind series or Dan Brown's book, but it's different as well.
Yes, it is. I loved the Left Behind series when I was younger, but for my mind, a couple things happened in that made it hard for me to relate to. One was, it took place after the rapture, so this whole sense of loss that the characters felt wasn't easy to portray. The other thing was that the Left Behind series took a look at events that are prophesied and made them in the book be totally supernatural events. And I think that there's another way to look at those prophecies and see them as, you know, scientifically verifiable events that are about to happen. And so for my mind, Left Behind left me feeling like I was in it more of a sci-fi model, a model where I didn't have to think that this is the way it could happen. Whereas the This Generation series tries to look at recent history and the near future and tries to use scientific theories or at least science-based theories that could explain the phenomena that we read about in the Bible.
As you've mentioned, this is a saga of three families whose lives collide with unknown forces bent on worldwide domination. So let's talk about these three families and the main characters in those families. First of all, let's talk about Kimberly Martin.
Now, Kim Martin is a young woman at the beginning of Precipice. She is a 17-year-old heiress from a fantastically wealthy family. Her parents are both dead. She has a half-brother who is a Catholic priest, but not particularly a nice man. She is bedeviled by dreams and nightmares of alien abduction. And she gets this sense that the aliens want to use her in experiments and use her genetically, right? They want to use her genetics in experiments. And she's afraid they want to make her pregnant. So she tries to undo that by going to a seedy bar and finding a couple men and getting pregnant. And that kind of sense, that sets out a whole series of events. Her son from this pregnancy is Michael, who is actually the lead character through the entire series. But Kim is particularly interesting, I think, because she gets over this and becomes quite a large player in the United States business arena. And she's building on a fortune that her father left, but she turns it into her own and becomes quite a dynamic character.
And then we also have Fran and Sarah. They're seniors in a small Texas Bible school.
Yeah. This is in 1969, right? And so some of us can remember back to 1969. And, you know, we'll see pictures of Woodstock and kind of like the freedom movement that was happening then. But there were a whole group of people who were still bound by older traditions, and these girls are in a Bible school, and you know, we're talking about a day and age when if women wore pants, it was considered to be possibly not scripturally sound for them to do, right? So we have in contrast to Kimberly, who is at this point not religious, these two are trying to figure out where they stand in a world that is changing very, very rapidly. Sarah marries her love, and they start a televangelist ministry. They explore freedom, but they really get enticed by the money that comes in, and it changes their theology. It takes them to places where Sarah never could have imagined that she would have been. Fran marries her boyfriend, and they go to Africa as missionaries. And actually, they're in Uganda when Idi Amin's government falls. And it's actually pretty thrilling. They have to escape Uganda as troops are coming into Kampala. So Fran probably stays with a more traditional religion, and Sarah moves toward the televangelist, name and claim it type thing.
And UFOs play a part in this. Aliens play a part.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In this particular instance, you know, I had to do a lot of research for these books, and there were times when I slept with the lights on because the stuff I was reading was so obscure and so unlike what I had heard. Now, there are some studies that show that people who experience UFO abduction have their lives affected a lot, very similarly to people whose lives are affected by poltergeist activity or what we would call demonic activity in the past. And you know, there's a man named Nick Redfern who's a, I liken him to a bit of a Carl Kolchak. He's a British writer. He investigates different things, but on kind of on the in the fringe world, right? Things that you're not going to see on ABC, NBC, or CBS. But he was contacted by a group of people. I think they refer to themselves as the Collins Group, but they were their think tank for the U.S. government. And one of the things that they were tasked with was assessing the U.S. government's interaction with alien technologies. Now, to get to that point, I mean, you have to believe that the United States government has come in contact with alien entities and just has chosen not to disclose this to us. But at any rate, this group of people maintains that the entities that the U.S. government is in contact with have promised technological advances that the government is using to stay militarily at the apex, so that we can basically, you know, rule the free world or make sure the world is free. But what this Collins group has said is the likelihood that we're dealing with aliens is far less than the likelihood that we're dealing with demonic entities, that entities that are what they declare interdimensional and have extreme malice for the human race. They've told the government that they think that this is going on. The government has said the technological advances are too much to forego and that they would just have to monitor the intent of the beings that they're dealing with. So you kind of put that into play, and that's how the aliens are part of this scenario. You know, it's really interesting. I just today finished a book. I'm probably going to write a blog on it by a physicist who has been studying results of the atmosphere in Mars. And what he's finding is that there are some isotopes of argon and krypton and some, I think, another inert gas that do not occur anywhere in the solar system except one place, and that is surrounding a hydrogen bomb test that the United States government did. And so he's proposing that there was actually a nuclear conflagration on Mars, and he's proposing that, you know, that what Mars shows, what that atmosphere shows, is that somewhere in Mars' past, probably he assesses it about 130 million years ago, something catastrophic and nuclear happened. And he doesn't know, really, could that have been natural or could it have been brought about by a malevolent entity? So it's not totally unscientific to think that there might be some malevolent alien beings out there who have had interaction with the world. From my perspective and from the perspective of the books, they are interdimensional and they end up behaving very much like demons of old world literature.
We've been talking to T.C. Joseph about his books Precipice and Pentecost. They're part of this generation series, and he's got a couple more in the works as well. So what's the best way, TC, to get your book? What's the best way to order your book?
Oh, Amazon. You know, go to Amazon.com and look under the name TC, the letters TC, last name Joseph, and you'll see the books Precipice, Pentecost, and Penance. And they got a lot of fun characters, folks. I mean, the whole idea of these books is to be thoughtful and compelling. So hopefully they'll make you think, but at the same time, they'll provide you with a roller coaster ride of action and fun characters.
And once you finish those, you have a fourth one that you're in that's in the works.
I do. Book four is in the works. book three left the main character kind of in a bit of a torture chamber, and I need to get him out of that. So we will we'll be starting that book pretty soon. And in book three, we've built a little bit of a mystery about how the characters have come to interact with each other. Then that's only resolved in their past. So the book five is precedent. The whole idea is that this generation refers to the generation that occurred when Israel became a nation again, because that sets forth how Christian prophecy, when things will start to unfold in the end days. But it's also a huge time because it's the end of World War II is when we became nuclear capable. It's the first time in the history of mankind that we're aware of that we were able to destroy our world. And so, and it's also that time period where people say UFOs crashed in Roswell. This, all of these things happen within about a two-year period. And that's what sets this generation that I'm writing about.
T.C. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you for having me. It's been a wonderful time.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Archway Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff. And find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Author Jonathan Kohlmeyer joins me from California to discuss his book and his story, Learning to Play the Game, My Journey Through Silence. Provocative term and provocative title. I will mention this about Jonathan. Jonathan Kohlmeyer was diagnosed with selective mutism when he was only 5 years old and social anxiety soon thereafter. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
This is a fascinating subject, I guess. I have met a lot of people who are socially shy or reserved. I'm from Canada, and Canadians are generally considered reserved. They don't usually get out in the middle of the floor and make a lot of noise. I was one of those exceptions, unfortunately. They had a difficult time putting a lid on me. You were the opposite of that. You preferred to stay in the background and sit quietly and observe. What brought on the diagnosis at age five?
So, like, when I entered into kindergarten, I would go into the building and, like, I wouldn't speak. I wouldn't sit down in a chair. I wouldn't eat. I wouldn't use the bathroom. I was so, like, afraid of everything else that, like, my body would just, like, shut down as soon as I walked into school. So, like, before that, like, I never really even spoke outside of the house until maybe I was, like, 7 years old.
Amazing.
I was just always so paranoid, so shy that, like, I was just too scared. And, yeah.
Do you think other children who display those characteristics are often diagnosed as having autism? Is that something that's a parallel, or what did they discover or talk about when they were visiting with you at, say, medical doctor's offices and so on?
Yeah, it took about, like, four separate doctors before we eventually came to, like, the conclusion about what was wrong. A lot of people didn't know about the disorder 15 years ago. It wasn't very common. Still today, it's not very well known. It's even more common in children than autism, and yet still people don't really hear about selective mutism. And when I was younger, they thought I was defiant. They thought, some doctors thought I had autism. Some doctors thought, like, I shouldn't be fed because I knew what I was doing and I was doing it deliberately, like, to get attention.
Mm.
So it was a very long process to go from finding the right person and who knew how to help me, which I was able to in Manhattan, actually.
Phenomenal that there was someone that recognized your symptoms and led you on the path to at least a solution that is manageable.
Yeah.
Would you call your mutism, but whatever it was diagnosed as, would you call it in current day, you're 20 years old at this point, is it just something you manage or is it something that you are overcoming or have overcome?
So I think, like, textbook-wise, I've technically overcome selective mutism, but I still do have, like, some remnants of social anxiety, but I'm able to manage it and live out my life. My parents are in New York. If you were to tell them when I was 20 years old that I would have left home and gone all the way across the country and lived by myself in a new city, they would have told you that you were out of your mind. That's how bad I was when I was 5, 6, 7 years old. Even when I was, like, 15, if you were to tell me that I would be in California, I would tell you you were crazy.
Incredible. You and it has not or does not reflect on your intelligence. Obviously, you're a bright guy. And is there a possibility, because you are bright or maybe even exceptionally bright, that this might have impacted your learning process when you were younger, not in a negative way, but may have made you more of an observer than a participant?
Yeah, I definitely think that the anxiety indirectly caused me to be somebody who's much more of an observer and somebody who does, like, pay careful attention to everything, like, people say, everything people do. I was a very good student in school after they figured out, like, how to appropriately teach me and how to appropriately handle me. But after that, and still today, school is one of the things I excel at.
I kind of figured that might be the case. I have met other people that are in that same category. They're diagnosed with one certain, they would call it an obstacle or a something they have to overcome. But really, underneath all of it is just, I don't mean to diagnose you as brilliant, but you probably are. They have a lot of brilliance and intelligence that is beyond what is observed on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you would fall in that category. Your book is certainly, at least from the outside observation looking in, would have been a difficult book to write. When did you begin writing it, and why did you want to share your story?
So when I was in my senior year of high school, we all had to do a senior project. And I went through some time to time thinking about what I wanted to do. I wasn't really sure, but I ended up I remembered when I was little, whenever, like, I was going through a tough time or something, my mom would always tell me, like, whenever you're ready to write a book, I'll be ready. Like, she would say it as a joke, but I guess I kind of took it to be serious. And after a few months, thinking about what I wanted to do for my project, I said, this is what I want to do. And I ended up maybe finishing 20, 30 pages by the time my project presentation came around. But over the next 2-3 years, I ended up finishing it and then publishing it. And I really, part of it was very, very cathartic. I was definitely able to learn a lot about myself and I would say about other people, but also I want to be able to share my story. And I think mental health nowadays is a very pressing issue. 1 in 5 people actually are diagnosed with mental health disorder in the United States, according to the CDC. So that's just, like, a crazy statistic that 1 out of every 5 people that you see walking around is suffering from something. And I think we need to be more approachable about it in society. And there's a stigma about it that I think we need to overcome. And I think one of the ways about doing that is having people share their stories and having people being open about it.
That's fantastic and inspirational just in your comments. You must have had a teacher or two or an educator maybe that went beyond their normal activities to invest in you. Is that something that's happened in your past?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. When I was younger, when the teachers thought I was, like, defiant, they usually weren't so interested. But after a while, they kind of, and as I got older, they kind of saw that I was kind of like different from everybody else, and I was really interested in learning, but I just needed to learn in a different way. And once I got like taken under their wing, I really excelled in school, and it was very helpful to have a few like point people in school to be able to go to. And also, I wouldn't be here today without the doctors that I had and the therapy that I went through. I think that's how I've become as successful as I can be today, be able to be on a radio show, be able to be in school across the country.
Fabulous. You, I would think, want to share this book with people who are in that industry. Is that one of your goals?
Yeah, I hope to be able to have parents be able to read it with, if they have kids that were dealing with this, teachers, doctors, but also really like kids themselves, showing them that they're not alone. When I was going through some tough times, when you think like you're the only one going through this and it's really tough, but knowing that there's somebody else who's gone through this and who's overcome it and is a functioning member of society and can do all the things that they want to do was something that really helped me. And I think I would like to be able to share that story for other people so they can kind of feel that.
And there's more to it than just the negative, difficult times you went through as a child and into your early adulthood or early teenhood. There's some inspiration behind this as well. Would that be a good way to describe your book as an uplifting story besides just sharing your diagnosis?
Yeah, there's the beginning is not so happy, but it definitely turns out well. And I think that's like the main point of the story and of the book, is that even though I was born with this disorder and I couldn't really function outside of the house when I was little, I've been able to overcome it. And I think people really need to see that people with these mental health conditions, they can be helped, they can overcome these certain obstacles, and it's really a way for us to, we can like be improved and it can be okay.
Absolutely. Your journey obviously is inspirational from what I am reading in your book. You have titled it Learn to Play the Game. Which game are you referring to, and what is the underlying message there?
So it is an interesting kind of like how I came to that title, but I when my parents were talking to me about like, or somebody would talk to me about how like how I manage the anxiety or this and that, I would struggle with how to like put into words. And I would, one day somebody asked me and I was like, you just have to learn to play the game. Cause I figure it's like a game that I play with myself, with my anxiety. It's always like there in the background, there like on my shoulder kind of. And, you just have to learn how to manage it. And I think my story in the book is me learning how to play the game. And that game, I consider my anxiety and how I dealt with it.
Is your recovery or your progress, is it related to medication, or is it more of a psychological training of your impulses and your desires to be more what are considered socially norm?
So it's definitely a little bit of both. I don't think one would have worked without the other in my case, but it's definitely everybody has different ways of doing it. But my way, I did have medication, and I'm still taking medication today off and on. It's something that I manage, and the therapy that I went through when I was little is very different from what I would be doing today, but it's still, I was treated both through medication and through doctors doing therapy with me, training those impulses.
As a career path, you are now a published author. What is your short-term and long-term goal in a career?
I'm not really sure, to be honest. I do hope to be able to spread the word about mental health issues in society, but it's definitely like not my only goal. I'm currently in school studying business and finance, but I do have this passion for this book and the industry of mental health awareness, and I hope to be able to help some people, I guess, along the way.
I am in reading your book or reading excerpts from your book. It's done in a very conversational way. It's one that will engage you almost like a novel, but it is your real life that you have shared. So I think it's exceptionally well done. The title of the book, again, is Learning to Play the Game. My Journey Through Silence is the subtitle, and my author, Jonathan Kohlmeyer. Jonathan, where can my listeners get a copy of your book?
The book is currently on Amazon. It's currently, you can buy it through Lulu, and it's also on Barnes & Noble online and also the iBook store.
Have you established a fan page or a web page for this or other things that you are endeavoring to do?
I do have a website, learningtoplaythegame.com, and also there's a Facebook page that you could like on Facebook.
Excellent. Have you been inspired by your writing enough to maybe share additional writing excerpts or writing passions in the future?
I have thought about maybe writing another book about where this ended and continuing on, playing the game. I thought would be an interesting title, but I'm not 100% sure about what I want to do. But I think maybe in the future, maybe in 20 years, I might consider writing an extension or something like that.
Well,
but not too sure.
This is excellent. Thank you, Jonathan, for coming out of the shadows and sharing this very, very important work about the challenges you've had with selective mutism and how it impacted your life and how you are dealing with it now and how you are overcoming it. So thank you again for sharing your story, and I would recommend this book to anybody. Again, the title is Learning to Play the Game, My Journey Through Silence. Author Jonathan Kohlmeyer. Kohlmeyer is spelled Kohlmeier. So if you're doing a search online, you can find Jonathan there and find his webpage. Thanks again for joining me today, sir.
Thank you.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, House of Daughters, and the author, Engen Enel Holstrom. She joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Engen.
Hi.
Great to have you with us, Engen. House of Daughters, a very unique view of a setting which probably most people don't know too much about. The Ottoman Empire is collapsing. The Republic of Turkey is coming into existence back in 1923. But in that setting, you have fashioned this story much like Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. You're developing characters, these daughters, the family, the romance, the intrigue. Anything else that you can give us just kind of broadly to kind of set the stage for getting to know more details?
Well, I mean, what you said is absolutely most of it, but maybe what I need to tell your listeners is that I'm a sociologist. I'm not a trained writer. This is my second novel. The first one I wrote because it was a story. I had to get it out of my system. But lo and behold, I found creative writing very enjoyable. I just loved it. You just sit down in front of your computer, scenes develop, you hear dialogue, you hear background music. I thought it was a rejuvenating experience. And once it was over, I missed it. I wanted to do some more, but I didn't know what. What am I going to do? Then I sort of remembered, why not my favorite book, Pride and Prejudice, by Jane Austen, and she had become very popular in recent couple of decades. There were a lot of new writers writing sequels or retelling her stories. I said, why don't I take my favorite characters from Pride and Prejudice, Darcy and Elizabeth, and make them Turks and see what happens. And that's how I started. Then I made the decisions about where, of course, Istanbul, that's where I was born and raised, and when. I decided on 1920s Turkey because, as you mentioned, the background was very dramatic, and I wanted my characters to be out of the drawing room, getting involved with what was happening in the country. I wanted them to be more active. After all, I was writing about 20th century and not 18th century. And how it started, and once I started, her characters became my own, and I think she would have been shocked to see some of the things my characters are doing. She would have raised her gentle eyebrows at some of the things my sassy, brave, young Turkish daughters do. But I think it works. And that's sort of a compliment, tremendous tribute to her, too. Her story works. Whatever you do with it, it works.
Well, as you point out, despite the exotic location, it's a universal storyline. Like you say, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl.
You know. And in between, there are all sorts of little things happening.
Yeah. Well, a lot of things are happening, obviously, because of the time and because of Turkey is going through such a dramatic political change. And I love just I'm looking at the beginning of your book, and the father of these five unmarried daughters, as he puts it, four of whom could easily turn any man's head. He just wonders, why, God, why aren't they married?
Yeah, it's an ongoing problem, isn't it?
Yes, and it has that familiar ring, I think, to a lot of parents, and they sometimes worry, especially about daughters. I think I have three daughters, so I know how I felt at that time, and thank God they're all married, so, you know. And so the House of Daughters, during this dramatic time, tell us a little bit about, do we need to know a lot about the father? Would that be a good place to start?
Well, yes, I think so, because he's sort of the cornerstone of the family. I mean, he's a nice guy, he's a quiet guy, he's blessed with five unmarried daughters, but he has a nice wife who's also a little bit difficult. He has a older brother, a domineering older brother, who's the head of the household, and he has this problem of what to do with his five daughters, because in early 1920s, Turkish girls, Turkish women were still sequestered behind the walls of their houses. They didn't go out much, and the wife wasn't very popular with the neighborhood because she was always bragging about how wonderful her daughters are, particularly the older blonde Melike, which happens, you know, it sort of corresponds to Jane Austen's characters. And she's a little bit out of she goes to her studio, he goes to her studio to paint, to run away from the woman folk and from his brother, and he's out of it a little bit. But toward the end of the story, not only the daughters transform themselves into more independent girls, but the father himself, his eyes open, and he sees things differently, and his relationship with his wife also changes. So the story is not only Turkey transforming itself, but the whole Emin Efendi's family, the saga, it's all about change and transformation. I hope that's what I wanted to do.
Well, you have an interesting little highlight of a scene out of your book with one of the daughters. Is it Perihan?
Perihan, yes.
Perihan, you know, as you call her, a feisty, intelligent young woman, and she has been asked in a very questionable plot to help in this clandestine plot against the British occupying forces. So kind of set that up and tell us a little bit about that.
That's one of my favorite scenes, I have to admit. Like you said, she's actually my Elizabeth, so she's in this she's the love interest of my Turkish Darcy, which is Major Murat. She's asked by her cousin's group of officers to help find where the British had been hiding the Turkish weapons they have confiscated. And these Turkish weapons are badly needed by the nationals fighting for independence in Anatolia. Now, Perihan is asked to attend this annual diplomatic garden party of the British embassy and try to sort of flirt with the British officers there and try to coax information out of them. And she's told, just be yourself, you'll do it. I mean, that's a little a crazy plot. But she goes there, and particularly her scenes with this Scottish officer whom they introduce, her cousin introduced, because they suspect him to be involved, to be in charge of this confiscated weapons. And she's trying to flirt with him. She's new to flirting. She's new to coaxing information from men. And she's stumbling, and she's trying to be ahead of the game. Meanwhile, she's at a table. Across the table is Major Murat, who's in love with her, who's seething with jealous fury, while at the same time trying to fend off the beautiful but oversexed wife of the French ambassador. And I mean, it's really a funny scene. I like it, and I hope the readers would. And I really wanted to also say, despite the seriousness of the background events, the book is written in a lighthearted way, and it's very humorous. And Scottish the officer McKay becomes my a comic relief. He is a nice person, and but he tends to get into woman problems quite frequently. If this was a 1950s or 1960s movie, he would be played by Gig Young. I don't know whether you remember him.
I do. Yes.
Gig Young.
Yes.
It's probably before your time. He was a very handsome, likable man, but a second banana that never got the leading lady. He would be played by him.
He wasn't Cary Grant.
No. He was always the second one after Cary Grant.
Yes.
But the book is actually very humorous.
Humorous, but also you deal with the actual dates of the historic events that shaped modern Turkey of today. So it's like you just said, it's serious, it's factual, And then, of course, you take license with your characters because it's a story. As one of your reviewers said, it's a thrilling blend of adventure, romance, and the personal courage of men and women during the birth of the Turkish Republic of the 1920s. So life goes on even when all this political upheaval is going on.
Life goes on and life changes.
Yes, life changes. That's a big part of your book, isn't it?
That's right. That's right.
Maybe
that's a little bit sociologist in me creeping in.
Because the political, national climate and environment is changing dramatically, and also the characters. They're going through a lot of changes because they're just human like all the rest of us.
Yes, they're being transformed by what's happening to them and what's happening in their culture and their society. Yes, exactly.
So why did you put this Harrington's Cup soccer match between the British and the Turks in your book? That is fiction. That is fiction.
No, that's not fiction. That's actually a real thing.
Oh, okay.
General Harrington was head of the British forces there, and he was a football fan. So from the first year on, during the 5 years of occupation, he wanted to play a football, a soccer match, actually, not football, not American football, but European soccer.
Right.
A soccer match with the Turkish teams, and only one accepted that because they thought that would be really unpatriotic. Unfortunately, every time they played, the British lost. So toward the end of the occupation, he wanted to have a final match, and he wanted to really defeat the Turks. So he got he made himself this very tall silver cup, Harrington Cup, and he told it, and he got a lot of good football players from other military units, and he challenged the Turks. So that challenge soccer match did happen. But what I did, I sort of used it as a background for the Turkish officers to come and steal the weapons that the British had confiscated. And it sort of worked. I think that was, it was like a Hollywood movie. It worked.
Well, it sounds like a Hollywood movie and a great, great theme for especially Jane Austen fans, but at the same time, I think everyone who loves that romantic story, especially with all this intrigue, because there's a lot of mystery in it, keeps you on your edge of your reading chair, if you will. And Engin, tell us, what's the best way to get your book, House of Daughters?
I was told by Archway that it's available from them, but it's also available from all online sources like Amazon. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and ebook versions. I guess it's available also Barnes and Noble's, online on Barnes and Noble's. And many other places. I'm sorry, they gave me a whole list.
Right, right.
But it's on most online sources.
Sure.
As the book.
Well, very, very good, Engin. We appreciate you being with us on Indie Book Publishing. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it. And I hope your listeners and your daughters and wife would go and buy it.
Well, I'm going to tell them about it, definitely, definitely.
Thank you.
This interview has been brought to you by Archway Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.